this is really an interesting window on the intersections of the war on Palestine as we're seeing play out in Gaza and beyond, and how that intersects with individual experiences in the United States in relation to migration and immigration. So here's my conversation with Isabeau Doucet for Free City Radio. Often media coverage about Gaza becomes very focused in a way that portrays the genocide taking place as occurring in, you know, one geographic location without sort of pointing to the ways that, of course, money, material, human beings move, and there's a lot of connections to people in Gaza all around the world, but also, of course, there's a lot of material relationships. Isabeau, your stories and reporting have spoken to the ways that migrant justice and Palestine are connected, and also, I think, illustrated in a meaningful way the ways that if we think about Palestine, we're also thinking about the world. And I think that that opens up a lot of points for a conversation. So maybe you could first introduce yourself and expand on any of that.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Stéphane. My name is Isabeau Doucet, and I'm a freelance journalist. And I've been writing some pieces about Palestinians, especially in the U.S. and or trying to get to the U.S. For The Guardian. And I spent kind of weeks, months interviewing Palestinians who had fled Gaza and were trying to seek safety elsewhere. And I found some, you know, really kind of just impossible situations that many of them felt, many of them faced. I don't think a lot of people realize the unique situations that the situation that Palestinians face in the international refugee system. Like, they're one of the largest groups of refugees in the world, and yet they're largely excluded from the international refugee system as it currently exists. And so they're kind of stuck in this state of limbo. They can't return, but they can't also go on, or they can't go on and, you know, seek safety in other countries in the same way that other populations have been able to, because they're excluded from the UNHCR, the international refugee system that was established after 1948. And then how this, you know, impacts on the ground in the U.S. is also very unique. They have been completely erased from even being able to be considered refugees or asylum seekers as Palestinians. Through my reporting, I found that, you know, despite the overwhelming violence that they face from the state of Israel, the U.S. does not recognize, doesn't recognize the existence of a Palestinian state. So, you know, categorizes Palestinian asylum seekers as from an unknown country, or categorizes, like, requires them to, even if they're seeking asylum, be registered as from, you know, a neighboring country like Jordan or Egypt, or Syria or Lebanon, even if they've like barely ever been to that country. So I interviewed this young man, Ali Al-Jamal, who had come here in September of 2023 to study as part of a State Department exchange program called the YES program. And he was supposed to just be here for a year, but the war broke out like as soon as he left. And the State Department, you know, would not help them, him and his other YES Gaza student exchange students from Gaza seek asylum or find any way of extending their student visas. So he decided to file for asylum. And when he went to register with USCIS, you know, they asked him to fill out a form like, what is your country of origin? And he put, you know, Palestine, Gaza, where were you born? You know, Gaza again. And they were like, no, sorry, we don't recognize Palestine. Just put Jordan instead. And I just thought that was so incredible. This kid is trying to seek asylum because of the, you know, the horrific levels of violence back in Gaza. And he's not even allowed to be considered like Palestinian, even though that's, you know, the group that's being targeted. So, yeah, even while trying to claim asylum, his Palestinian identity, the facts of his persecution, the facts of where he was born are not enterable in the asylum system, that he has to like lie basically and say that he's from Jordan, a country he briefly passed through on his way to Gaza, even though credibility is crucial in any kind of asylum claim. You're not supposed to lie on an asylum application. And here you have the situation where the government is basically telling him, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to lie, or you're going to have to say that you're from this other country. Looking into this, you know, through Freedom of Information requests, found like there's even a 2018 memo from USCIS, US Citizens and Immigration Services, basically outlining what the rules are, that you could only put Palestine as a country of origin on any kind of immigration application if you were born there before 1948. And so, you know, this has like ripple effects for so many different people. I also spoke to this professor in Michigan who was born in what is now Israel, and he, when he became a U.S. citizen, had managed to tell the USCIS officer, you know, to put his country of birth down as Palestine, even though he was born in 1949. The person who issued him his citizenship, you know, didn't know the sort of 1948, 1949. You know, it slipped through the system. And this meant that he was able to, for all of his life, visit his friends and family who lived in Lebanon, because his passport said that he was born in Palestine. But under Biden a couple of years ago, when he went to renew his passport, it, you know, somehow something got jammed in the system and his application took months to process. And finally, when he got his passport back, it suddenly said he was born in Israel, and that meant that he is no longer able to travel to visit his family and friends in Lebanon. His mother was born in Lebanon. So there are all these little kind of, it seems so small, you know, and technical, but it has like these real huge ramifications for people. And I just think it's really not well understood, just this kind of position, this like limbo that Palestinians have been in for generations now. And then this erasure, I guess one of the questions that I was trying to find out, and I, you know, I must have emailed like a dozen, you know, scholars and lawyers and people, and I still haven't actually quite gotten an answer. But one of the things that a lot of the attorneys, the immigration attorneys I spoke to, said was that Palestinians face a higher burden of proof when trying to seek asylum. And often they have to prove persecution by someone other than the state of Israel in order to qualify. Meaning that, you know, they have to be, I don't know, LGBTQ, or, you know, have converted from one religion to another, and or be somehow persecuted by the Palestinian Authority or someone other than the State of Israel in order to qualify for asylum in the U.S. And likewise, for refugee status, you know, it's very, very difficult for Palestinians in Gaza or in Palestine to qualify as refugees. Often they actually have to flee to a third country, to a different country, and apply as refugees from there. But again, they can only qualify if they are claiming persecution by someone other than Israel. And I was trying to think, well, why is this? You know, is this just, is this just that the U.S. is politically disinclined to recognize persecution by an ally? I mean, yes, obviously. But is there maybe also a legal reason? And this is something that I'm still kind of looking into. Would it trigger something legally for the U.S. to be admitting refugees who are being persecuted by a U.S. ally and by, U.S. supplied weapons? Is there something in U.S. law that would somehow be triggered and require, some sort of consequence for the U.S.-Israel alliance? If they were admitting all these refugees from a country that the U.S. itself was causing, I'm not sure. I mean, it's not unique to Palestine either. There's lots of countries in Latin America who have had U.S. coups and U.S. supplied weapons causing people to flee. But yeah, I just think it's an interesting question if it's kind of legal ass covering on the part of the U.S. to refuse to recognize any kind of Israeli state violence.
Thanks for sharing all that, Izebo. There's a lot to look into. I think that what you've shared speaks to the administrative elements of violence that often Palestinians face, which I think the narratives really focus on militarized violence, which of course is important to focus on. But then on an international level, there's all this administrative violence, which often is processed through the context of people trying to achieve status. It brings up, I think, a mirroring in different ways around how to understand interconnections of an anti-war movement or a movement to stand with Palestine and migrant justice, because there are connections. But let's say for reporting at this moment, when there's a lot of protest of Trump's attacks on migrant rights, there isn't an inherent connection made. But I think it's an important topic to explore. So what do you think about that?
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many interconnections. And I think that the bureaucratic side of things is something that, people's eyes slightly glaze over because it is kind of tedious, the language and just the sort of the Kafkaesque kind of nightmare situations people are faced with. That is very much violence. Right now there are people who came to the U.S. under Biden and went through, the system as it existed at that time. And, we're here kind of waiting for asylum or, legally, and are now just being rounded up and disappeared for all intents and purposes.
Thanks for sharing that. It's important to underline. Can you talk about why you dug into these particular stories as a journalist and as a reporter? There is, of course, an increasing focus on lifting up Palestinian voice and speaking to, how that plays out in terms of everything from listening to Palestinians talking about their own experience in Gaza or Palestinian experiences outside. But the context is that there are millions of Palestinian experiences, the vast majority of which are within contexts where the capacity to articulate and access outlets is deeply restricted due to resources, due to colonialism, due to enclosure, occupation, many other contexts. And I think that this brings up an important question around thinking about why it's important that people still stand up with Palestinians and make the effort to report and share these types of stories. I think that people can get a bit lost in sort of like a certain type of discourse that would remove the capacity for people to lift up the stories like the ones that you've reported, which are obviously ones that are important to know about.
Yeah, so I got into this, I mean, I think just on a personal note, I have, you know, dealt with some, you know, immigration, kind of being stuck in an immigration abyss. You know, I had some... two passports stolen once while I was heavily pregnant and ended up having to go back to Canada in order to get a new visa. And then the US government accidentally canceled the new visa that they had just issued me instead of the one that was in the stolen passport, and linked my brand new passport in their system as having been stolen instead of the stolen one. And that caused huge complications for me on a personal level. So I think, you know, I'm just kind of interested in these like situations where people are, you know, through no fault of their own, stuck in a kind of Kafkaesque situation. And I think Palestinians are, you know, really... you know, at the front of the queue in terms of this kind of nightmarish, you know, bureaucratic citizen hellscape. In terms of why I focused on U.S. immigration, I'm based in California, and I was, you know, working with an editor at The Guardian, and she could, you know, she's in New York and, you know, could only really commission stories that have a U.S. angle, because obviously they have a whole team covering, you know, the Middle East. It wouldn't make sense to have a journalist in California, you know, writing about, you know, the war itself, even though no journalists can get into Gaza anyway. So whether you're in California or you're in Egypt, doesn't, I mean... obviously, it makes a difference, but you know, no one's actually on the ground other than the amazing journalists, brave journalists in Gaza. But yeah, I was focused on U.S. angles to what was happening for families trying to get their, you know, loved ones, for American citizens stuck in Gaza. Trying to get out, and again, like that's also a whole other, you know, I spoke to a mother who was there living there with her son, her American, who's American, living there with her American son, and she had just gone to visit but decided to stay because they were having such an amazing time reconnecting with family and just, you know, living just a quality of life in Gaza in terms of community that that she couldn't have in the U.S. And so she just decided to extend her stay, and their passports got expired. Their passports expired and she had to renew them. But being in Gaza, she wasn't able to get to the U.S. embassy in Jerusalem. They just would not issue her a travel permit, even as a U.S. citizen, to travel to from Gaza to Jerusalem. And their passports... you know, eventually she decided to go to Amman, Jordan. But this is only after like months of back and forth. And before she could go to Amman, the war broke out. And then she was stuck in Gaza with her, you know, two U.S. citizens stuck there, you know, with expired passports. And, you know, the U.S. government, you know, wasn't particularly helpful. So yeah, that was another story that I had previously covered. And yeah, I guess originally we wanted to follow up, you know, see who's actually able to get in. We were looking at, you know, children being allowed into the U.S. For medical treatment, and yeah, eventually just decided to look at a bunch of different immigration kind of nightmares that people were facing, you know, after finally managing to get out of Gaza, which already is a very limited number of people. Like people were then having to deal with a whole new bureaucratic nightmare, just trying to find safety here or elsewhere. So yeah, I spoke to a couple of people who were turned away at the border, you know, having after having the U.S. embassy help them evacuate from Gaza with their children. You know, one family I spoke to, they again had a child that was a U.S. citizen, and the U.S. embassy in Cairo helped them get a visa for their other child who's not a U.S. citizen, and they had valid visas, and when they got to landed in the U.S. they were sent to secondary screening and separated. The two parents were separated and interrogated for 24 hours, and the mom says she was basically like kind of almost like trapped, or she was like repeatedly invited to apply for asylum, even though she had no intention of applying for asylum. They have family here, and they just wanted to sort of, you know, spend a couple months here, expecting that the war would wrap up within a couple of months, and then they'd go back home. And you know, after, you know, being kind of interrogated and pressured to apply for asylum, she said, okay, yeah, fine, sure. Yeah, she just thought maybe that would be a way for her to be able to, you know, enter the country for a couple of months and be reunited with her husband. And as soon as she said yes, the immigration officer, you know, became really enraged and basically threatened to throw her husband in prison and separate her from her kids if she applied for asylum. And then told her that her husband had requested to be deported to Jordan, where he had citizenship. And so she said she would like to retract her asylum claim, you know, in order to be like reunited with her husband. And then when she was reunited with him for like 1 minute before he was deported, he said, "That's not true. I never requested to be deported to Jordan." So she felt like she was basically tricked into applying for asylum and then requesting to cancel the asylum claim, which basically would mean that she wouldn't be able to apply for asylum in future, because that would be considered the immigration attorney who I spoke with, who had filed a complaint on her behalf, said that the fact that she had tried to apply for asylum and then retracted it could be used as evidence to undermine her credibility in any future asylum claims. So it's like this kind of trap, like you finally make it out of Gaza, you're interrogated at the border, you're like invited to seek asylum, and then when you finally say yes, that's used against you to, you know, threaten to separate you from your kids and then also prevent you from ever applying for asylum again. It's just like this kind of surreal situation where, like, you know, I don't know, like, I don't know what the correct way to proceed even could be.
Well, you're speaking about this legal limbo that has played out in many contexts around the world for Palestinians across the globe dealing with legal regimes that don't recognize the humanity of Palestinians. And it also brings up this very important point to just underline that I heard many times recording voices in Lebanon or Syria or Jordan where Palestinians were seeking to have full citizenship rights not because they didn't want to return to Palestine, of course, but because of the lack of daily rights people can't access due to the fact that they're not a citizen, access to certain services or employment. And it brings up this larger question of dehumanization that plays out at various levels. And having your perspective and insights around your reporting, Isabeau, in relation to these cases in the United States, I think is important to lift up in relation to understanding the interconnections between Palestine solidarity and migrant justice. So thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, you're so welcome.
That was a conversation with Isabeau Doucette, who is a journalist based in the Bay Area. Isabeau reports for The Guardian and other outlets, and recently has done an important series looking at the realities of the intersection of anti-Palestinian racism in the context of genocide in Gaza and how that intersects with migration control in the United States and the reality of Palestinians as stateless people trying to claim asylum. Thank you, Isabeau, for being on the program today. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on CGLO 1690 AM, also in Montreal, on Wednesdays at 8 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We're also a podcast. Look us up on your podcast streaming platforms. Just search Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoff. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Share music and voices from genres and cultures around the world, reflecting you and the rest of your community. You make CJSF diverse.
Standing up against racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
Everyone should be treated equally, and the legal system should work for the people, not against them. Every day, our network of supporters, lawyers, and educators from across the country continue to fight against injustice and oppression, both in and outside of the courtroom and at all levels of government.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.